From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Michael Caine. Caine has appeared in more than 70 films in roles ranging from the leading man to a psychotic cross-dressing killer, from a Cockney womanizer to an upper-class con artist. He's worked with John Huston, Brian De Palma, and Woody Allen. He starred in movies that are considered classics and in movies so bad no one remembers them. We'll talk to Michael Caine about his life, his choices, and some of the techniques he's used to create the characters he's played. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new satirical novel by German writer Günter Grass, who's best known for The Tin Drum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. government has secretly indicted several people allegedly involved in terrorist actions against American interests overseas, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
There have been sealed indictments against alleged terrorists for some time, administration officials said today when asked about a report on cable news network this morning. According to CNN, U.S. authorities have indicted suspects in the abduction and killing of American hostages in Lebanon. The U.S. officials who requested anonymity would not say whether there have been any new indictments against alleged terrorists, referring those questions to the Justice Department, which declined to comment. Meanwhile, the State Department has been running ads overseas, offering rewards of up to $2 million for information leading to the arrest of alleged terrorists. The ads are part of an ongoing reward program, which has resulted in prosecutions, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said today. He said reward money has been paid. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Shining Path rebels kept up their terrorist campaign in Lima, Peru today, apparently trying to disrupt the congressional election set for Sunday. For the third day in a row, the Shining Path claimed responsibility for bombings around the city. Rebel graffiti and pamphlets threatened to kill commuters if they tried to go to work tomorrow or Thursday. Peru's elections are already threatened with a boycott by the country's two largest parties, which say that the new Congress will only legitimize a dictatorship by President Alberto Fujimori. Fujimori seized power in April after dissolving the previous Congress. The African National Congress is pressuring the president of South Africa to deal with senior military officials. The officials may have conspired with a secret agent who says he planned a campaign to destabilize the ANC. The government's chief power-sharing negotiator, Rolf Meyer, who was Minister of Defense at the time, says he knew nothing of the plot that's alleged by the agent, Ferdi Barnard. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
Barnard, a man with a violent and shady past, called a news conference to say he'd been employed by the head of staff intelligence, but that his plans for a dirty tricks operation against the ANC had not been accepted. Barnard's denials will cut little ice with the organization that was the target of his operation. Speaking on state television, Mr. Nelson Mandela called on President de Klerk to take immediate action against those involved in the conspiracy. It is now a question of Mr. Rolf Meyer's word against the evidence of the official files. He is generally regarded as a man of integrity and one of the more forward-thinking of government ministers. For that reason, the ANC will be more likely to use this scandal to push for a multi-party government than to bring about the downfall of one of the few government figures the organization actually likes and respects.
Fergal Keane reporting. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points today to close at 3,193. This is NPR News. Polish President Lech Wałęsa signed what amounts to an interim constitution today designed to increase the president's power and sweep away the remnants of the communist regime. The action establishes a set of new constitutional amendments that will give Wałęsa a greater say in appointing a government and increase his control over the armed forces. They also strengthen the government's powers to introduce urgent economic laws by decree. The changes are known as the Small Constitution. They're designed to allow the government to function until a full new constitution is approved to replace the one drawn up by the communists. A U.S. Court of Appeals ruled today that former President Richard Nixon is entitled to compensation for the Watergate tapes and other papers that were seized by the government. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
In the wake of the Watergate scandal in 1974, Congress passed a law that severely restricted Mr. Nixon's access to his presidential papers and to the secret Oval Office tape recordings that helped implicate him in the affair. Congress was afraid that Mr. Nixon might try to destroy or limit access to the materials to hinder further investigation. The former president has been fighting the law in court ever since, arguing that the seizure of his papers amounted to an illegal government taking of private property under the Constitution, and he was therefore entitled to compensation. Today, a 3-judge appeals court panel agreed, saying that Mr. Nixon had a well-grounded expectation that the materials were his own personal property. And the judges sent the case back to a lower court, which now has to decide the complex question of how much the government should pay its former leader. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Continental Airlines released its latest reorganization plan today, saying it expects to emerge from bankruptcy early next year. The plan would be financed by a $450 million cash investment from a group led by Air Canada. The Air Canada group would acquire 55% of the restructured airline. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Caine, has made over 70 films in 30 years. He first established himself as a playboy in Alfie and as a crook-turned-secret agent in The Ipcress File. More recently, he won an Academy Award for Hannah and Her Sisters and starred in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Mona Lisa, Educating Rita, and Dressed to Kill. Of course, some of his more than 70 films were stinkers, like The Swarm, Jaws the Revenge, and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. In his new autobiography, What's It All About?, Caine tells his story from his birth in the charity ward of a hospital to his coming of age in a working-class neighborhood and his rise as a movie star. Caine has said that an actor's eyes are his most important asset. His voice is the second most important asset. Caine has one of the most distinctive voices in film. I asked him how he realized his own voice was an asset.
Well, I realized that when I first went into the theater, my natural voice, having a Cockney accent for a start was difficult, but also it's where the voice was placed. Cockneys naturally talk. I'll try and get up there. It's right up in the throat here. It's rather like John Major, our Prime Minister. He talks like that, and the trick was to bring my voice down to the diaphragm. If you could imagine, if it's right up here in the throat, and then they bring it down a little bit further, like another one of our politicians who talks like that, and it's rather strangulated. But if you're going to boom out in the theatre without deafening the people at the front, you've got to be able to project your voice. And my first wife taught me how to do that in about 20 minutes. And that was the most important thing that ever happened to me with my voice, which was it was placed. And the second thing was that over a period of years, I never went to the normal diction lessons that you had. British actors always spoke terribly like that, and they all spoke exactly the same because they all learned how to speak at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And what happened to me is I worked on my own, because I was never a trained actor, and I worked on my own voice. So what happened was, as I came out of it with a voice that was correctly placed by accident and a very, very individual accent. My accent is so individual that people who don't recognize me by sight, the minute I open my mouth, they know who I am.
Absolutely, absolutely. So how did you learn how to lower your voice? What did your wife tell you in that 20 minutes?
It's very difficult to do on radio because she put her hand on my throat, and if what I'm doing is I'm putting my hand on my throat, and if I talk up here, and if you were to talk like that, and you got your hands on your windpipe, you'd find it all very tight, very very tight, and then she gradually moved down to the top of my chest, and then felt the vibration, and said hit the vibration, and she put her hand on my chest at the top. And said, hit, make the vibration hit there. So my voice came down to sort of here, and then she brought it down a little further, and I hit the vibration there, and then she brought it right down to the bottom, which is the diaphragm. And it was just a case of making her hand vibrate on my chest as she brought her hand down.
Now, when you decided to work on your accent, what did you do to work on it?
Well, I didn't do anything, really, because I went into repertory, and which means that I'd used to do a play a week for 50 weeks a year. So I was always playing someone different. And in England, we have a lot of regional accents, lots of class accents. And so I could do almost any accent. So what I actually did was I kept my own voice. What actually altered my voice tremendously was becoming a movie actor in the United States. When Alfie was released here, the first inkling I got that it was going to be released in America at all, because I'd never been to America when Alfie was made, I didn't expect the film to come over here. But the first inkling I got was they said, you've got to do 125 loops, which means lines of dialogue, which are on a sort of tape loop, to make it more understandable to the American ear. And so I did 125 American loops. And if you actually listen to the American version of Alfie, it sounds as though I can't do a Cockney accent because I keep getting it wrong. But, I mean, it was deliberate. But also I very quickly realised that it wasn't the rhythm of the voice that worried the Americans, it was the speed. The British speak very, very quickly and very, very in a very clipped way. As a matter of fact, I lived in America for a long time. I lived for 9 years in Los Angeles, and I remember on one occasion I had been in America without leaving for about 10 months. I hadn't been back to England. And I was watching a British film on television with everybody talking terribly like that, the British clipped away. And I suddenly realised I couldn't understand what anybody was talking about. And I realised the American problem. It's because we cut off the end of words and we talk terribly, terribly quickly.
Did your Cockney accent stand in your way at all when you were first starting to make movies? Because England has a much more rigid class system in a way than America does, although we certainly have a class system here.
Yeah, well, you have a class system here, but you can't tell it by people's accents. In England, I can listen to a person and I'll tell you how much his house costs, how much he earns, what sort of car he drives after listening to him for 3 minutes. That's how defined by accent you are. The only drawback with a Cockney accent was nobody, of course, would put you into Shakespeare because you have to learn how to speak in verse and iambic pentameters and everything. But even that, I did. I did Horatio. I played Horatio to Christopher Plummer's Hamlet on television and got away with it. But normally, in England, in the theatre, when I came into it, there were no leading parts written for anybody in my natural accent. I always had to put on another accent. So in actual fact, from that point of view, it did hold me back a bit for a while.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the actor Michael Caine, and he's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? Now, in the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which was made just a few years ago in the States, you and Steve Martin starred, and you were this really kind of upper-class, elegant womanizer who who came onto wealthy women and scammed them and took their money, whereas Steve Martin was a real kind of nickel-and-dime scam artist out for the same thing, wealthy women, and you taught him how to really do the more aristocratic version of it. What kind of accent did you use for that?
Well, that would be the British upper-middle-class accent. It was always the people, the upper-middle-class usually have the pretensions of the aristocrat without the class and also the pretensions of the rich without the money. And so what you get is someone with absolutely no substance who is all front. And so you get a voice which is terribly like that, and it's very smooth and very, very slow.
Now, another great role that I have to ask you about your voice in was in Mona Lisa, in which you played played a crime boss, a gangster.
Who
Bob Hoskins played somebody who is kind of under you in there, and you were really intimidating him in your scenes in the film. It's a fantastic performance by you. Can you talk about how you used your voice in that? Because you needed to use it in a way that showed real authority and the willingness to intimidate and, if necessary, hurt somebody.
Yeah, authority is shown not only by voice but by movement. And what it is first thing in authority is you never move. Only people who are trying to attract your attention with no power move their hands. If you look at aristocracy and really powerful people, they move very little because everybody is awaiting their every word, wish, or command. And their voice is very, very slow, because everybody will wait while they have their thought, and wait no matter how long it takes for them to say what they're going to say. What you have to add, in this case where I played a gangster, which would be menace. And menace would come if you were... I had a gangster accent, which is, again, a working-class Cockney accent, but there is a sort of cheerful, chirpy working-class sort of, hello, lads, let's all go down the pub and all this, you know, that sort of accent for the chirpy Cockney lad, cheerful little soul. But then there's another one, which is, it's kind of very drawn out, and it's very flat. And so they will actually say things to you. I grew up with gangsters like this, and they will say, I like you. And there's absolutely no emotion in the voice whatsoever. It's like an icicle. You know, they say, I think you're one of the nicest fellas I've ever met. Really do. I really think you're very nice. So, and then they say silly little things. When you know you're in trouble with a Cockney gangster, he'll say something like, well, who's been naughty then? Now, that question means you're probably going to get kneecapped to the floor. But it's one of those things of just flattening the voice out. The voice just flattens right out. No matter what you say, it just flattens.
Now, when you say you're in a position of power and authority, you don't move a lot.
No.
That means you don't blink a lot, too.
No. Oh, that's a trick for actors on film that I used, and it was told. I think the first place I heard it was Marlene Dietrich who said it first, is that you don't blink. If you blink on camera, it signifies weakness. It's very difficult to do this trick on radio about blinking. But if you look in the mirror yourself, and just stare and start saying things to yourself, you'll see how powerful it is. And if you just blink once in the middle of it, you'll see how it all dissipates. It just dissipates the whole thing. And of course, if you're on a movie screen, you have to remember when you blink, each eyelid is somewhere between 2 to 7 feet wide. If you're in a close up.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, how do you learn to not blink? It's hard to not blink. Your eyes start to hurt. You can do it for a little bit, but after a while, it's a real strain.
You just walk around. I walked around all my life. When I was a young lad, I wrote about this in the book. When I was a young lad, I found a book in the public library, How to Teach Yourself Film Acting. And the first thing it said in it is, you must not blink. And so I walked around this sort of working class district of London, which was used to some very rough people, you know, without blinking. And I looked like a sort of early serial killer. I'm sure I frightened the life out of people, because I used to have long conversations with people and never blink. And I would watch people getting hypnotized. And they would walk away from a quite simple conversation with me, quite flummoxed as to what went on.
My guest is Michael Caine. He's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Michael Caine is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? You were born, actually, not only working class, it was a really pretty poor family. You were born in the charity ward of the hospital. Your father was a porter at the fish market, your mother a cleaning woman. You spent several years in an apartment that had no electricity.
I never lived in a house that had electricity until I was 12 years old, which was in 1948.
So what did your friends think of your ambition to act?
Oh, they thought it was complete and utter, completely ridiculous, utterly derisory. I was just treated with absolute contempt by everybody, or ridicule.
No, why ridicule? I mean,
because, well, for a start, people of my class and in that society never went into show business. No one knew anybody who was in show business or anything, and also, like my family, the male members of my family would regard any male going into show business or acting as being homosexual anyway. Or a possible homosexual. There was a tremendous gay inference. I mean, we didn't use the word gay in those days. But if you said... When I said to my father I was going to be an actor, it was the equivalent of telling him I was a homosexual as far as he was concerned.
So did you feel that you had to do things to prove your manhood while studying acting?
No, I was already doing those, but my father didn't know about it.
But I think I get what you're saying.
Yes. But I really had to prove to him. I married very young, which I sometimes think was an effort to prove to him that I wasn't gay. And I had a child when I was 22. I had a daughter when I was 22. And of course, with his simple-minded way of looking at it, he was again wrong, because the fact that I was married and had a baby meant to him that I was definitely not a homosexual. And so he was wrong in both cases, you know, because there are a lot of people who are married with children who are homosexuals. But he had a very simplistic view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a very, very tough man. I mean, and it's very hard to put across to anybody, to get across to anybody just how tough he was. Back again to the gay analogy, he actually thought that any man who ate chicken was gay.
Chicken?
Yes.
Why?
Because this red meat thing, you know, real men ate red meat and all this stuff, and he thought that was sissy food, chicken.
Did he ever come see you in a performance or
no.
See your movies?
No. No, he died. He died when I was completely out of work, completely broke. He died of cancer when he was 56 years old. So he never. His one of my great regrets in my life is that his last memories of me was as a complete and utter disaster and failure. But at least he knew I wasn't gay because I had a wife and a child.
Right. In your masterclass acting video, you say that most screen tests show fear. What was your screen test?
My screen test was for, which showed fear, was for Zulu. I did a screen test for Zulu. I did it on a Saturday morning, and I saw the director, Cy Enfield, at a party I did it on a Friday morning. I saw the director, Cy Enfield, at a party on a Saturday night, and he ignored me all evening. So I thought, oh, well, he's seen the test. That's gone. And then just as he was leaving, about midnight, he was leaving this party, he came over to me on the way out and he said, that was the worst screen test I've ever seen in my life. I said, all right, well, that's fine. You know, he said, but you've got the part. So I said, well, if it's such a bad screen test, why are you giving me the part? He said, because we can't find anybody else and we leave on Monday. So that was how I got into Zulu. But the test was terrifying for me. We did it you know what happens? All your life you think, I think I would work on screen. You know, because there is something magical that happens on screen. You know, if you work, if your personality or your talent or whatever it is works on screen, there's something happens. And then when you get the screen test, now you're going to find out, without a doubt, whether this something is there or not. And no matter how good or bad an actor you are, you can't fake that. The camera either likes you or it doesn't. And there's nothing you can do about it. And that's what and I knew this, and that's what terrified me about my screen test, because I was going to see, they were going to see up on the screen whether I had anything. Well, what Cy told me later was, he said, although the acting was appalling and the nerves were dreadful, he saw something else, and that's why he gave me the part. So that's what I was afraid of, that if you spend your whole life saying, give me the chance and I can prove it, suddenly someone gives you the chance, you suddenly say, my God, I've got to prove it, I've got to prove it.
Yeah.
And that's where the nerves come in.
Did you ever see that screen test?
No. I think they burned it.
Well, here's what I'm wondering, you know, since you learned, obviously, by making movies, how did you pick up everything that you know now about how to look into a camera or how, like, where to look when the camera's looking at you? Did you pick that up over years after watching yourself and watching yourself?
No, I never watch myself. I never see rushes, and I only see the finished film once, just to see how it turned out and who goofed, including me. And no, it's film is listening, reaction, and behavior. That's what film acting is. It shouldn't be called film acting at all, because it's not acting. It's something entirely. Acting is what you do on stage, as far as I'm concerned. And people behave. The only time real people act is if they're showing off or trying to make an impression, like a guy with a girl or something. Then they act, and then they're artificial, and we can all see they're artificial because they're acting. But normally what you do is you listen and you react and then you behave, and that's all it is. And I, when people say to me, well, what actors did you watch to learn how to act in movies? I said, I didn't. What I watched was documentaries or people on the subway to see how they react to things. Because you'll see actors, like, for instance, making gestures on the phone with no one there. You don't make gestures on the phone with no one there. You think you do, but you don't. And so you get sort of strange things happening like that when you see actors acting.
Mm-hmm.
So I never took any notice. The only actors that I ever watched for acting lessons were minimalist actors like Jean Gabin, the French actor, and someone who was remarkably similar to him, which was Spencer Tracy. I always think that Jean Gabin and Spencer Tracy, if you speak French, you'll find they're absolutely indivisible.
Now, but what about where to look when the camera's looking at you? I mean, you really learned how to work
Yes.
in front of a camera, and if you didn't spend a lot of time watching yourself, how did you learn that?
No, well, I learned by watching where the camera was. I mean, for instance, you always, if you're going to, the thing is, if you're going to play a part, you're playing a part with another actor and you look in their eyes. And what you do, if you're acting, you suddenly go, well, how do I look into this person's eyes? Now, during your lifetime, you've looked into hundreds of people's eyes every time you speak to someone, but you can't remember how you did it. And what you do is you only look into one eye, because if you look into two eyes, you go cross-eyed. And the one eye you look into is the one that is nearest the camera, because that throws the one eye that you're not looking in, not using, straight into the lens.
Huh.
That's how you do that.
And how'd you learn that?
I figured it out. How to do it. I figured it out myself, actually. I figured out a lot of stuff myself, because you get a feeling in movies when you play someone. The actor should disappear and people should only see the person. I mean, it's a self-defeating thing in a funny way, because half the time people see me and they say, well, he's only playing himself. It's because I've made the actor disappear. And that's where you come down to this thing where you've got behavior and where you've got the camera. You can come down to the absolute minimum thing to do for the camera to pick up. And that's what's fascinating about film acting, because camera always finds it.
Michael Caine, his new autobiography, What's It All About, is published by Turtle Bay Books. Michael Caine will be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, part two of our interview with Michael Caine. Michael Caine has appeared in so many films, he's been criticized for not choosing his roles more carefully. In part two of our interview, we'll talk about his criteria for choosing movies and about why he turned down Alfred Hitchcock. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews The Call of the Toad, a new novel by German writer Günter Grass, author of The Tin Drum. The Call of the Toad takes place just before reunification. It's already been published in Germany, where it's been very controversial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton has chosen former South Carolina Governor Richard Riley to head a job screening operation for top government jobs. Riley has been mentioned as a possible education secretary, but he said today in Little Rock his goal now is to work on a team to carry out Clinton's agenda. The former South Carolina governor will work with Clinton and his cabinet on filling sub-cabinet and federal agency jobs. Bill Clinton heads for Washington tomorrow in his first visit to the nation's capital since winning the presidential election. During his two-day trip, Clinton will meet with President Bush at the White House tomorrow and have talks with congressional leaders Thursday. In Germany, health concerns have forced officials in Berlin to suspend charges against a second co-defendant at the trial of former East German leader Erich Honecker. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The trial of six members of East Germany's former National Defense Council is bogging down over the poor health of the aging co-defendants. The one-time communist leaders are charged with manslaughter in connection with the deaths of defectors along the former inter-German border. Berlin justice authorities say they are temporarily dropping charges against 84-year-old Erich Milke, the former head of the East German secret police. Milke is also on trial in Berlin for the murder of two policemen in the early 1930s. Court doctors say he is not strong enough to appear at two concurrent trials. At the trial opening last week, charges were also suspended against former East German Prime Minister Willy Stoff, who recently suffered a heart attack. The second trial session yesterday was broken off after 80-year-old Erich Honecker complained about circulatory problems. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In an effort to improve relations with the United States, the Libyan parliament has appointed a new foreign minister, apparently in a move that is hoped might lead to an end of an impasse over the 1988 bombing of a Pan Am plane over Scotland. Jackie Rowland reports.
The Libyan deputy leader set the tone for the parliament session when he called on the new American administration to turn the page in relations with Libya. A further signal was sent to Washington when the parliament voted to fire the foreign minister. He had been blamed for Libya's failure to defuse the Lockerbie crisis. In his place, the parliament appointed Omar al-Muntazir. He is a former prime minister, and most recently he was involved in Libyan attempts to bypass the United Nations and negotiate directly with Washington. The choice of al-Muntazir is a clear sign that Libya wants to improve its relations with the United States. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 12 points to close at 3,193.32. On volume of more than 185 million shares, trading was active. This is NPR News. According to government officials in Moscow, Russia has cut some 180,000 military personnel this year, with plans to lay off 20,000 more by the end of the year. Most of the former Soviet armed forces have been turned over to Russia, and a force of nearly 2.8 million is expected to be down to 2.1 million by 1995. Next month, Russia's army will start taking in volunteers, with plans to have them comprise 10% of the military in 1993. There has been an increase in draft evasion in Russia because of fears that soldiers will be sent to areas of ethnic unrest. Military housing is also in short supply. In Paris, transportation has been severely disrupted by a strike that is expected to continue through the end of the week. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Transport workers staged a two-hour strike this morning during rush hour. The between 5 and 7 a.m., only one in four trains were working. But when the strike resumed during the evening rush hour, there were even fewer trains. The Paris Transport Company, the RATP, has announced that it has to close several lines for the rest of the night. The protesters say they'll continue the strike through the end of the week. They're angry about a planned reform of driving conditions. Drivers say the reform will force them to work longer hours. They're demanding that the RATP hire more drivers. They announced the strike several days ago, and the RATP withdrew the reform temporarily, hoping to avoid chaos in the metro. The strike is a major headache for commuters. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A tractor-trailer loaded with military explosives turned over this morning on an interstate in Texas. The driver of the rig suffered minor injuries. The truck was on its way from El Paso to Atlanta when the accident occurred. Morning rush hour traffic was blocked. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 7 biographies of Michael Caine have been published. I guess he wasn't satisfied with those books. He's just completed his autobiography called What's It All About? Caine is back with us for the second part of our show. Let's get this part started with Michael Caine, the early years.
I first started to act when I was around 10 in school plays. But of course, I was the first generation, I imagine, at my age, I'm 59, I was about the first generation of actors who the first actors they saw were movie actors, not theatre actors.
And so that left you with a different kind of entirely different
role model of how to act and why I wanted to act and what I wanted to act in. I've been an amateur actor in theatrical plays in little youth clubs and all that for years before I ever went to see a play in a theatre. I'd done 20 plays in a theatre before I'd ever seen a play in a theatre.
So your ultimate ambition wasn't necessarily to do Hamlet. It might have been to do crime films or something.
No, my heroes were James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart and Spencer Tracy, not John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier, who were the big sort of theatre stars when I grew up in England.
I guess that helped, too, in terms of your class, because it would have been hard for you to aspire to be somebody who had this kind of upper-class accent and, you know, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts kind of thing.
Absolutely. And there was always a history, in any case, in American movies, you had working-class heroes. You rarely had working-class heroes in British movies. It was always about the aristocracy. If it was about the war, it was about officers. If it was American about war, it was about enlisted men. And so I always identified more with the United States, with American movies and American actors than I ever did with British ones, because I thought that the American actors, and in many cases I was right, were of the same class as me, whereas I absolutely knew from their accents and their demeanor that the British actors I was watching were not of the same class as me at all. And therefore, it negated any ideas that I had of becoming an actor, because people like me did not become actors in England.
Do you feel a stylistic connection to American actors, too?
All the time, yeah. The naturalistic way of playing, right through from the Stanislavski and the method and the whole thing. I mean, I went along with that as a young man, rather than in the sort of very British theatrical declamatory fashion of acting, which is why I was always much happier in movies than I ever was in the theatre.
Mm-hmm. Now, you made 73 films in 30 years.
Yeah.
And as you say, some people have criticized you for not being discriminating enough in the movies that you chose to make.
Yeah.
What has your criteria been for deciding what to make?
Well, first of all, my criteria was nobody asked me to make anything for 30 years, so my first criteria was that they asked me at all.
Yeah.
You know, and then there came... I then had to learn how to make act in films. So I made as many films as possible, as fast as possible, in order to learn how to do it, because I'd never done any. I didn't have any gradual work up. I was suddenly a leading man, and I was fighting for my life, you know, along with all the other movie stars in the world, and I had to give a performance. So I did a lot of stuff. And then also my other criteria were, and this is one of the great failings of what had the people done before? I remember after Anatomy of a Murder, Otto Preminger asked me to do a picture, and I thought, here's this great Hollywood director asking me to do a picture, which was a dreadful picture called Harry Sundown, But, I mean, I was so complimented that Otto Preminger had even asked me to do a picture that, I mean, I would have almost done it without reading the script. I mean, I did read the script. I didn't understand it, but, I mean, I knew that I didn't even understand Otto Preminger because he had a thick German accent. But I was just so complimented that this great Hollywood director had asked me to do this film. I went and did it. You know, people always talk as though, first of all, I was never an American star. So I was never this person sitting like a Paul Newman or someone in a room where every new great script that came out came to me first. I was a foreign actor, and I was never offered the great American parts because I wasn't a great American actor. You know, I was a British actor. And so what eventually I had to make a career out of what all the American stars didn't want, which was usually flawed people. There's another thing with that. If you think in terms of, it still happens, like with British actors, we always get flawed people to play. The last three Academy Awards have been British actors. Daniel Day-Lewis, My Left Foot, mm-hmm. a flawed person. Jeremy Irons, he played the Klaus von Bülow, a man accused of murdering his wife, a flawed person. Anthony Hopkins, a cannibal, God knows, a terribly flawed person. And these are all parts that great American stars, I'm sure, turned down and said, my audience will not allow me to do this.
Well, let's look at
and they quite rightfully did so. And so we are the actors that I've mentioned, we are stars by default in America in a funny way.
You got your Academy Award for Hannah and Her Sisters, playing somebody married to a character played by Mia Farrow, but you're having an affair with your wife's sister. Flawed person, I guess.
Again, always flawed. I mean, I played the transvestite psychopathic killer.
And Dressed to Kill.
Dressed to Kill. I played two homosexuals. I've played all sorts of weird characters. I mean, I can't see Clint Eastwood doing Dressed to Kill, dressed as a woman, going around killing people. I did it, you know, and I'm just as tall as he is.
Now, it's interesting to me, early in your career, Alfred Hitchcock offered you a role as a sadistic killer in Frenzy.
That's right,
But you turned that down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here you are talking about flawed people, but you didn't want to play that role because
I knew who he was based on. He was based on Neville Heath, who was an extraordinarily early, extraordinarily sadistic British woman killer, and I wouldn't play it. I mean, all those years ago, Hitchcock never spoke to me again.
Because you turned him down?
Yeah, he never. I knew him quite well, and because he comes from the same part of London as I do, I knew him quite well. I mean, I wasn't a close friend or anything, and I'd never been to his home, but I always sort of saw him around Universal and restaurants. But I remember I had lunch with him for that film, and I said to him, I said, there's something I've got to bring up with you. I said, you said that actors were cattle. And you know the way he talks? No, I didn't, he said. I said actors should be treated like cattle. There's another voice. And that's a sort of halfway, trying to be terribly middle class and that's a Cockney trying to get it right.
And speaking very slowly, too.
Yeah, Hitchcock was a terribly powerful person, so everybody listened and waited for him to say anything he liked, except for me. I said, I don't want to do the part, and he never spoke to me again.
My guest is Michael Caine. He's written a new autobiography. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Caine is my guest. Since you've given so much thought to the placement of the camera and the difference between theater and film and so on, I want to ask you about doing love scenes in front of the camera. You don't like doing love scenes very much. That's certainly the impression I get from your book.
No, because, you see, for a start, if you're a very good actor, you see, and you play a scene, I will play a murderer, you know, and my wife will see the picture. She'll say, I thought that was brilliant. You know, I mean, you were so convincing as a murderer, right? So I'm a very good actor, and I played a very good part as a murderer, and my wife thinks it's very convincing, and it's fabulous, and she's very pleased with me, and I'm a very good actor. If I put the same amount of sincerity and skill and dexterity into a love scene, she says to me, was there anything going on between you two?
Right.
You see, so you can't win. You can't win. Because if you do it for real, if you're really a good actor, you really look as though you love the woman, you know? And it's very difficult for someone else who loves you to watch that. So I don't like doing them. And also, love scenes often involve a lot of kissing and cuddling and sometimes nudity and all that, and I hate it all. It sort of gets in the way of everything. And all the big stars on the old days, they never did any of these scruffy love scenes and rolling about. And if the girl has to take the clothes off, then there's nervous breakdowns and things going on, and it's not worth it. I couldn't do a nude scene. I've never been able to do it. I mean, I've looked as though I was nude, but I never take my shorts off. I always keep my shorts on.
Have you turned down movies because you didn't want to do a nude scene?
Yeah, I turned down. What was the movie Ken Russell directed where Oliver Reed and Alan Bates wrestled?
Women in Love.
Women in Love. Yeah, I turned down that
because of the nude wrestling scene.
Well, for a start, I turned down the thing because I won't appear stark naked in anything, you know. And the other thing, I couldn't imagine wrestling a naked guy, you know. I thought, so supposing I like this, I'd be in trouble. It's
like, sounds like your father's influence coming back
my
again.
Father, I said, well, my dad will be spinning in his grave if I'm rolling around on the ground with Alan Bates with no clothes on. I thought, the hell with it. So I turned the picture down.
Do you think your father's fear of homosexuality stuck with you?
No, I don't have any fear of homosexuality. But he didn't have a fear of homosexuality. He had a fear of me being a homosexual. There was no chance of him being one. He wasn't worried about himself. He was worried about me. And I'm not worried about me. It was just the done thing in those days, you know. There was tremendous homophobia then.
You know, it strikes me you are a very close observer of other people's behavior. But doing a love scene, you'd be at something of a disadvantage because it's not like you've sat around watching a lot of couples make love. Do you know what I mean? You could say, well, yeah, this kind of person makes love this way and that kind of man makes love that way.
Yeah.
So you must have to use your imagination more to imagine your character in a romantic situation. Imagine them on the telephone, which you've been able to witness, or imagine them at dinner, which you've been able to witness.
Yeah, with the love scenes. But I've been imagining love scenes since I was 10. All sorts of different ones. So, I mean, I've got one for every occasion, whatever. I mean, I was very sort of oversexed when I was a little boy, and I saw love scenes on the screen, you know, which were kissing, but was very soon found out what happened when they cut to the seagull or the train going through the tunnel. I figured out the significance of that very quickly. and of course, right through my teens, I had all these imaginary love scenes worked out, and I managed to get them all out of my system on and off screen over the years.
You've described yourself as a very unneurotic person. Do you think that that's affected your approach to acting?
Yeah, I have a very unneurotic approach to acting. Basically, it's my style of acting is like most actors would hold up a picture and say, look at me. I get rid of all that baggage by holding up a mirror and saying, look at you. So what I'm doing is I'm playing you, not me. And so therefore, I can watch from afar, and I watch for the neuroses or the behavior in people that I can reflect off my mirror.
You still do that now?
Yeah, all the time. If I've been a success and you see a performance, even if you're a woman, You should say, how does he know that about me? How does he know I would have done that there? How does he know that's the way I would have reacted? It's got nothing to do with the sexes or anything. It just has, its human behavior is remarkably similar.
One more thing, and this gets back to eyes. You know how the eyes, you've said the eyes are the most important part of an actor.
Yeah.
You were born with an eye problem called a blepharo.
Yes.
Which puffs the eyelids.
Yes.
So did that make you self-conscious about your eyes? Did it make it any more difficult for you?
Yeah. At school, they used to call me snake eyes because I have, I sort of have eyes like a cobra. But when I grew up, sometimes if you're very sleepy, you look like a cod. They used to call me cod's eyes as well, but until I sort of grew to 6 feet tall, and then nobody called me cod's eyes. but when I got into the movies, it came out as kind of dreamy and sexy, you know, sleepy looking, because they could use makeup on them and sort of make them look slightly different. They put a bit of shade, which puts the eyes back further into your head, and you get a sort of dreamy quality. So there was a producer once, an old theatre producer, said, use the disadvantage. Always use the disadvantage. And so I use that. A lot of things work for me like that in my life.
What else?
Well, I was just thinking, when he said use the disadvantage, what that means is I was rehearsing. Use the difficulty, he used to say. I was rehearsing a play, and there was a scene went on before me, and then I had to come in the door. And they rehearsed the scene, and one of the actors had thrown a chair at the other one, and it had gone right in front of the door where I came in. So I opened the door, and then rather lamely, I said to the producer who was sitting out in the stalls, I said, well, look, I can't get in. There's a chair in my way. So he said, well, use the difficulty. So I said, what do you mean, use the difficulty? He said, well, if it's a drama, pick it up and smash it. If it's a comedy, fall over it. Which was a line for me for life, you know, always try and use the difficulty.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
On that note, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Michael Caine. He's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? And your next movie is the Muppet movie, the Christmas Muppet movie.
That's right. I play Scrooge in the Muppets Christmas Carol movie.
I just saw the trailer for that. It actually looked really funny.
It did. You know, all actors say their next movie, the movie that's coming out, is going to be great. But I'd never worked with the Muppets before, and it's a very special movie.
Well, good luck, and thank you again.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. These are some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. Deborah Wong reports from Hanoi on the meetings between American and Vietnamese officials on identification of the remaining American soldiers missing there. We'll hear about the Catholic Church's proposal of a new catechism from Orthodox and unorthodox sources. William Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, will be profiled. He could represent a new kind of leader for the Republican Party. And a review of the new movie Malcolm X. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ever since The Tin Drum, German writer Günter Grass has consistently challenged the direction and values of his country. His most recent collection of essays, Two States, One Mind, argued against the reunification of Germany. Critic John Leonard has a review of Grass's new novel, The Call of the Toad.
They hated The Call of the Toad when it was published in Germany last May. There he goes again, all the reviewers seem to say, making fun of German culture and German efficiency, and everything profound that Germans are supposed to feel about blood and soil, night and death. These critics needed to punish Günter Grass for his pessimism about reunification of the two Germanies, for his predictions of mass unemployment and xenophobia, for his having been right about the Deutschmark and the skinheads. So busy were they, in their jackboots, stomping all over The Call of the Toad, you'd never have guessed that it's a funny and loving novel, an autumnal valentine to the redemptive decencies of memory and desire, of food and flowers and affection. We begin shortly before the fall of the Berlin Wall, in a marketplace in Gdansk, where the elderly German widower Alexander, an art historian and iconographer of the Gothic, meets the elderly Polish widow, Alexandra, a restorer of Baroque angels and Rococo altars, the Gildress of ornate emblems. Their hesitant courtship consists of Boletus mushrooms, red rust asters, and some cemetery hopping to admire the epitaphs. Both had brothers who died in World War II and are buried on the wrong side of post-war borders. In death, they tell each other, enemies stop being enemies. They conceive a plan that will be incorporated as the German-Polish Cemetery Association. Suppose you're a German soldier who died in Poland, or a Pole who perished in a German camp, the ultimate refugee. Or suppose, like Günter Grass, you grew up in Gdansk when it was still called Danzig and want to be buried where you were born, despite history and despite politics. In our brave new Europe, should the dead need visas? Alexander and Alexandra will arrange, by computer, for a traffic in corpses to ancestral homelands. Reconciliation, fraternity, Lebensraum. Naturally, fast-buck vampire capitalists cash in on this innocent idea with a golf course and a beach resort, health spas and fern bars. Just as naturally, everybody will be too embarrassed to think about the Jews. Meanwhile, alongside the gridlocked roadways, in the polluted water and the polluted air, toads cry out in lamentation, woe is me. And as we might have expected from the author of Headbirths and Show Your Tongue, there is also a strong and suggestive Asian presence in the capital cities of the former imperialisms, as vividly embodied in the Bengali Mr. Chatterjee with his fleet of rickshaws. That none of this ends well is not the fault of Alexander and Alexandra, both of whom Grass likes a lot. This grave comedy is in fact the least sour of his last several books. As if from that dentist we first met decades ago in local anesthetic, our Kashubian Cassandra has inhaled some laughing gas. Grass grins through the vaporous stink. You have to love him if you're not a German. Still making trouble at age 65. The last good liberal, practical radical, ferocious Democrat, self-made orphan, citizen without portfolio and prophet without honor, a bad boy and hard cheese skeptic, ashamed of his very own white male perks, a holy fool instead of a court jester, incapable of simplifying himself in the gridwork of profit-taking, self-congratulation, false consciousness, and bad faith, the conscience of the West.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Indian novelist Shashi Tharoor. His satirical novel Show Business is about the Indian film industry. Tharoor also works at the United Nations and is currently heading up the UN peacekeeping forces in the former Yugoslavia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.